Chapter 26. By the time he came to groggy consciousness, Geoffrey was already halfway to the moon, and a minor diplomatic squall was busy playing itself out back on Earth. Mechanism apparatchiks were not at all happy about Geoffrey having absconded before submitting to a psych assessment, and they were taking an increasingly skeptical stance regarding Jemai's supposed innocence in the whole affair. The Nigerian had committed no direct wrongdoing. But the message, in no uncertain terms, was that it would be in her absolute best interest if she were to submit to MEC jurisdiction at her earliest convenience. In other words, she was a whim away from being declared a fugitive herself. Tiamat, meanwhile, and by extension the Panspermian Initiative, was using every stalling measure in its arsenal, arguing that because Geoffrey had requested a Qualogy citizenship, it had no option but to discharge its own procedural obligations in this regard, and that if it did not do so, it would be in grave dereliction of its charter. Smoke and mirrors, bluff versus bluff, two geopolitical superpowers playing an old, old game. As long as it bought Geoffrey time, he didn't really care. Worse, as far as he was concerned, was the reaction of the cousins. Lucas and Hector had been trying to ching from the moment he was picked up by the Nevsky. Their requests had been systematically rebuffed, and Geoffrey had been unconscious for much of the ensuing time, but the cousins hadn't been daunted. They'd had no trouble tracking the Nevsky, the movements of any seagoing vessel, let alone one as large and ponderous as a former Soviet nuclear submarine, were publicly visible, and they'd had no trouble making the obvious connection between the Nevsky's destination and the lifter's descent into orbit. Geoffrey had dropped off the mechanism's radar, so they couldn't be sure he was in space, but he wasn't anywhere else under mechanism jurisdiction either, which did rather argue for him being aboard the rocket. It would not have taken limitless resources to track the rocket's rendezvous with the deep space vehicle Quanor, and to presume that Geoffrey and Jemai were now aboard that ship. When they had eventually given up on trying to speak to him directly, Hector had recorded a statement, one that Geoffrey had finally felt obliged to listen to.
"We know what you intend to do, cousin. We know what your new friends think they will help you to achieve. But you are wrong. This will not work. You are making a very, very serious mistake. You have no business in the Winter Palace, and you have no right to trespass where you are not welcome."
"I have as much right to it as you do," Geoffrey mouthed.
"If you have ever thought of yourself as an Akinya," Hector went on, "do the right thing now. Turn around. Abandon this folly. Before you damage the family name beyond repair."
"Fuck the family name," Geoffrey said. Then softly, "Fuck the family while you're at it. I'm out." There was a dull, propellant roar from somewhere in the ship. A ghost of gravity as the ship trimmed its course, and from that moment on the Quanor was aimed like an arrow for the orbiting prison where his grandmother had ended her days. "Not much to look at," Jemai said, 6 hours later, when they had their first good view of the Winter Palace. "I don't know what I was expecting. Bit more than this, though." She paused to tap her medical cuff, instructing it to up her anti-vertigo dosage. Geoffrey had caught her vomiting into a sick bag a few hours into the flight, curled into a fetal ball in the module that had been assigned as her temporary quarters, making dry, retching sounds. He'd asked her why she hadn't managed the nausea, and she'd said that the cuff's chemicals took the edge off her concentration, and for Jemai, that was less acceptable than the occasional heave. "We need you sharp at the station," he'd argued. "That means not being worn out from puking your guts up before we get there." And he took her wrist, gently, and tapped up her discretionary dosage to match his own. "Yes, doctor," she'd said, half sullenly. But the message, he was relieved to see now, had got through. She had it built around her old ship, the Winter Queen, he said, when the grey cylinder hung before them, massively magnified. They were still 50,000 kilometers out, so the imagery was synthesized from distributed public eyes in cislunar space, rather than the Quanor's own low-res cameras. I never went inside it, of course. Never even chinged up there. But I know what it's like. Saw images often enough. Whenever she deigned to address us from her throne. It's a jungle, humid and sticky as a hothouse. Ship's a rust bucket. It was just about capable of keeping her alive, supplying power to the station, but no more than that. That's why the cousins can make a good case for decommissioning it. The reactor's almost as old as the one in that submarine. The cylinder had the proportions of 2 or 3 beer cans stuck together top to bottom, bristling with docking-stroke-service equipment at either end. It was rotating slowly, spinning on its long axis, bringing most of the surface into view. Between the end caps, the station's outer skin was smooth, uninterrupted by machinery, sensory gear, or anything that might indicate scale. Eunice had wrapped her own iron microcosm around herself, and she'd never felt the slightest inclination to see what was outside. "She never left this?" Jemai asked, the horror seeping through her voice. "I mean, not even step outside in a suit? In all that time?" "We'd have known. There was never a point when someone somewhere wasn't watching the Winter Palace. Ships came and went occasionally. Automated supply vehicles. Memphis on one of his errands. But no one else ever came out." Her star may have faded, but even in her last years, she was still enough of a celebrity for that to have made the news, if it had happened. But to live inside that thing, after all she'd done, all she'd seen, how could she do that to herself? "By going a little mad," Jeffrey said. "She could ching, I suppose, but that wouldn't have been enough consolation for me." "You're not my grandmother. Whatever she needed, it was in there."
"That's not living."
"Never said it was," Jeffrey replied. After a silence, Jemai went on. "Well, we dock first, that's clear. Then we see how easy it is to break inside. Figure you expect some complications or you wouldn't have brought me along." "If you don't have to lift a finger, you still get paid," he reassured her. "You still think I'm a mercenary to the core?" "I think you like risk, not quite the same thing."
"In your book."
Jemai gave an unconcerned shrug. Her nausea blasted away for the time being. "So let's see what our docking options are." And she reached out and tumbled the image of the Winter Palace, like a toy suspended over a cot, until she'd brought one of the end caps into view. She plucked her fingers to zoom in, frowning at the details. "See anything out of the ordinary? You're the seasoned space traveler, not me."
"Can't say I'm any kind of expert on docking systems." "You don't need to be," said a voice behind them.
It was Mira Gilbert, weightless now, fully divested of her mobility harness, but equally at home in zero gravity as she was underwater. She wore a skin-tight, zip-up orange and grey outfit, fitted with pockets and grab patches.
"We've assessed the situation, perfectly standard interfaces and capture clamps. The Quaenor will be able to hard dock without difficulty."
"You came just to tell us that?" Jeffrey asked. He'd barely seen Gilbert since his revival.
"Actually, I came to tell you that there's been a development back at the East African Federation. Public eyes detected the activation of the Kilimanjaro ballistic launcher."
"Fuck," Jeffrey said.
"Not sure what came up. Could be a test package, a cargo pod, or something else. Right now, we're leaning towards something else. Whatever it was got pushed all the way to orbit, where it was met by another vehicle."
"What kind?" Jemai asked.
"The Kinieti, an asteroid miner registered to a Kinya space," Gilbert answered slowly, so the words had time to hit home. "Something with at least the range and capabilities of the Quaenor, if not greater."
She pulled up an image. Either a long-range, real-time grab or an archival picture of the same ship. As far as Jeffrey was concerned, he could have been looking at another view of the ship he was traveling in. The Kinieti had the same skeletal outline, built for operations in vacuum with no requirement to withstand atmosphere or hard acceleration-deceleration. It had engines and fuel tanks at one end, docking and mining equipment at the other, and a pair of contra-rotating centrifuge arms mounted at the midsection bulge of her main crew quarters,
with habitat modules on the end of each arm. He'd seen the Quaenor's arms from inside the ship. They were static, welded into immobility, their only remaining function to serve as outriggers for comms gear and precision maneuvering systems. "Been on high burn ever since it met the blowpipe package," Gilbert went on. "Keeps that up, it'll reach the Winter Palace about 90 minutes ahead of us."
"Has to be one or both of the cousins," Jeffrey said.
"This caught us with our flippers off," Gilbert said. "We didn't think the blowpipe was working yet."
"It wasn't," Jeffrey told her. "Not properly. They tested it when my grandmother was scattered, but it wasn't ready for people. Not by a long margin. Only Lucas or Hector would be fucking mad enough to risk their necks riding the blowpipe."
"They want to catch up with us. They wouldn't have had much choice," Gilbert said. "Libreville would have taken too long to get to, and they didn't have access to their own rocket. Would have been blowpipe or nothing."
"Someone means business," Jemai said.
"But we knew that already. Okay, what does this change?"
"Nothing," Jeffrey replied. "We're not turning around. Can we squeeze some more speed out of this thing, Mira? Now that we no longer need to hide our intentions."
"Depends on how fast you want to go," the merwoman said, "and how many space traffic violations you want to stack up."
"Enough to make sure the cousins don't get there ahead of us. All we need to do is shut them out. Shouldn't be too hard, should it?
We get in, find out what, if anything, Eunice left behind up there, and leave. And then, if at all possible, we can all get on with our lives."
"This is your life now," Gilbert reminded him gently. "Citizen Akinya." Jeffrey touched the damp, warm glass of Arethusa's container, trying to make out the form it held. With the way the hold's lights were arranged, he could discern little more than a dark, hovering shadow in the green-stained murkiness of the water tank.
"It's an extravagance, of course," Arethusa confided.
Her voice came straight into his head via the ship's onboard org.
"Moving me around? I'm not just meat and bone like you. I weigh 50 tons to begin with. And I also need thousands of liters of water to float in. But they can owe me this one. We have fuel to spare, or at least we did before your family decided to race us to the prize. And in an emergency, my suspension fluid can always be used for coolant or reaction mass or radiation shielding."
"What would happen to you?" Jeffrey asked.
"I'd die, very probably. But I wouldn't object to the basic unfairness of it. Doesn't mean I'm tired of life or ready to end it. Not at all. But I've long since reached the point where I accept that I'm living on borrowed time, every waking instant."
"I still don't understand. Why now?"
"Why what now?"
She sounded unreasonably prickled by the question. "Don't tell me you just decided to leave the planet at the drop of a hat, Arethusa. Something's prompted this. Where are you going anyway? You can't stay in the Winter Palace."
"I don't plan to. But it's been time to move on for a while now. I bore easily, Jeffrey. Life in the Aqualogy stopped offering me challenges decades ago. And for that reason alone, I need new horizons. Oculus finally given me the spur to make the transition."
"To leave Earth?"
"I've been thinking about it for a very long time. But this news, the Crucible data, the Mandala, and the death of my old friend Eunice, it really feels as if the time is right. Carpe diem and all that. If I don't do this now, what else will it take? We Pans preach outward migration, exploration, and colonization as a species imperative. The least I can do is offer deeds instead of words."
"You mean to stay in space then?"
I'm not going back,
she affirmed.
And most certainly not after all the fuel expenditure it took to haul me up here. Do I want to look profligate?
She fell silent, ruminating in darkness. The tank chugged and whirred.
There's a whole system to explore, Jeffrey, she said eventually. Worlds, moons, cities and vistas. Wonder and terror. More than Lin Wei could ever have imagined, bless her. And that's just this little hurdle of rock and dust around this one little yellow star.
You are Lin Wei, he said quietly. You never drowned. You just became a whale. She sounded more disappointed than angered.
Can we at least maintain the pretense for the sake of civility?
Why did this happen to you?
I made it happen. Why else?
She sounded genuinely perplexed that the question needed answering.
It was a phase.
Being a whale.
Being human.
Then, after a moment,
we both became strange, Eunice and I. Both turned our backs on what we once been. Me in here, Eunice in her prison. We both lived and loved, and after all that, it wasn't enough.
The impulse to defend his grandmother was overwhelming, but he knew it would have been a mistake. At least you haven't turned into a recluse. You're still in the world on some level. You still have plans.
Yes,
Arethusa acknowledged.
I do, even if now and then I scare myself with them.
Do you know why she hid herself away?
She was never the same after Mercury. But then again, who was?
Arethusa paused. She was still Arethusa to him. Try as he might, he couldn't relate this floating apparition to his notion of Lin Wei, the little Chinese girl who had befriended his grandmother back when the world was a simpler place.
My doctors, the people who helped shape me, tell me I could live a very long time, Jeffrey. One way to cheat death is just to keep growing. You see, I'm still forming new neural connections. My brain astonishes itself.
How long?
Decades. Maybe even a century. Who knows? No different for you, really. You're a young man. 100 years from now, do you honestly expect medicine not to have made even more progress?
I don't think that far ahead.
It's time we got into the habit. Every living, breathing human being. Because we're all in this together, aren't we? We endured the turmoil of climate change, the resource and relocation wars, the metaphorical and literal floods and storms, didn't we? Or if we didn't, we at least had the marvelous good fortune to have ancestors who did, to allow us to be born into this time of miracles and wonder, when possibilities are opening rather than closing. We are all Poseidon's children, Jeffrey, whether we like it or not.
Poseidon's children, he repeated. Is that supposed to mean something?
We came through, that's all. We weathered the absolute worst that history could throw at us, and we thrived. Now it's time to start doing something useful with our lives.